Hello, comrades, and welcome back to Season 4, Episode 11 of Spectre. I'm absolutely delighted today to be joined by Zoe Alexandra from the People's Dispatch. Zoe, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Excited to talk.
No, great stuff. Well, I guess just to kind of start then with an introduction from yourself, you know, who you are, your affiliations, and everything else in between.
Yeah, well, I am the editor-in-chief of People's Dispatch. We were founded in 2018, and since then, basically our mission has been to cover, you know, all sorts of Global South news. And yeah, I'm a journalist, cover Latin America specifically, but, you know, all the US imperial policy across the world.
Yeah, and that policy is enough to keep MD busy for a while.
Yeah, precisely.
Well, no, that's great. I guess just on the People's Dispatch then, kind of highlighted when you were founded, but I guess just as an insight for those who somehow haven't heard of yous yet, you know, who yous are and what yous do, because it's quite a wide scope you guys have got, which is great. And you cover such in-depth topics.
It's an international media organization, which means that we cover the entire world. And I'm very proud to say that we have audience in, I think, every single country in the world. And yeah, largely focusing on movements and people's organizations across the world, and then covering geopolitical developments from an anti-imperialist perspective. And that has been extremely crucial in the last couple of years, as we've seen so many new developments in the world, unexpected, you know, actions taken by different movements or actions taken by different countries that have kind of, in a lot of ways, caught the movement on the back foot. And I think we've been able to intervene in a lot of ways to provide kind of that solid anti-imperialist analysis. We have very strong relationships with movements across the world, in South America, across the African continent, in Asia, always in dialogue with them, providing, you know, great interviews with people who are really on the ground every single day in the class struggle, whether it's Indian farmers who have been resisting corporate takeover of Indian agriculture, or trade unionists in South Africa, or people struggling for land in Latin America and against the far right. So, you know, if you're looking for voices from any of those struggles, People's Dispatch is the place to turn, because we are the ones who are speaking to those people and trying to bring you that analysis without the jargon, without, you know, trying to make it very digestible so that we can all be more informed as we advance in the struggle for a better world.
No, fantastic. And People's Dispatch is great. It's that staunch opposition to that, you know, capitalist controlled media, the Murdoch press. And, you know, I suppose any opposition to the Wall Street Journal is good in my book. So, you know, it's always refreshing to have it. And the fact that there's so many kind of avenues, like you said, about being digestible, obviously podcasts like this one for people to consume, obviously your own radio shows. Seen the ones with Roger McKenzie, fellow party member, a comrade of mine. It's just great to have so many different avenues for people to kind of take this stuff in, and more importantly, kind of keep up to date with politics, in a sense. I feel like, you know, more and more ordinary working class people are just being so excluded from this idea of politics. You know, it's something that we're told is well beyond us. We don't have an understanding of it, and, you know, we should just, you know, leave it to those who be. But, you know, having this coverage, the People's Dispatch on social media, podcasts, YouTube shows, etc., just means that ordinary people can, you know, be aware of what's happening, how they're being exploited, duped, and everything else in between. So, no, it's great to hear the work you guys are doing. And I guess just to bring us on the kind of first topic, or the first point, sorry, for this show, we've chosen the subject of NATO, the most dangerous organisation in the world, as it's been categorised. We talked just before the podcast kicked off about why, you know, we felt this was an important aspect to cover, and why People's Dispatch were good to cover it. You know, NATO, as we've seen over the last couple of years, especially with the Russia-Ukraine war, has been this growing drive to war through the rearmament of Europe in most recent terms. More and more countries across the EU and in Britain as well, spending more and more of their GDP or increasing their military capacity. Some try to disguise that as their defense capacity as well. And that's meant more, millions and millions of pounds, of euros, etc., being funneled into these private armed firms. And that's just kind of recycling happening with the building of NATO to strengthen up to be this monster that we saw it in the Cold War, even after the illegal overthrow of the Soviet Union, when you saw NATO kind of fully expose itself with the war in Yugoslavia. So I think always the best place to start when talking about NATO, because it's such a kind of complex history. It's not one that's ever ended. It's still ongoing till today. But just to kind of look at NATO, its foundations, and expansion kind of since the Warsaw Pact period to what we're seeing now, if you're okay to give us a kind of wee brief rundown.
It's a big task, but I think, as you said, it's so important. And especially because right now we are seeing a shift in terms of how the US views NATO, but I'm sure we'll get to that a bit later. Donald Trump is not as fond of NATO or the US's role in NATO as previous US presidents have been. But you laid it out perfectly. I think, NATO founded in 1949 in the post-war moment. With certain declared objectives to create again this kind of like treaty and military alliance, founding members were just 12 at first, if you can believe it. Belgium, Canada, Denmark, France, Iceland, Italy, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, United Kingdom, and the United States. And it's I mean, I think it's important to remember like who were the original countries that founded it. Because of course it has grown to a lot more. And it was founded as, in name, kind of like, okay, we're going to be this defensive pact. We just got out of this horrible war. How can we defend ourselves in the future? But, and I like that you use the formulation, the most dangerous organization on earth. This is the title of the Tricontinental Dossier on NATO that came out in June of this year. And I really recommend people check it out. It's a really good document because it brings a lot of stuff to light, and it connects. I mean, it draws a really good thread from NATO's founding to NATO's actions today and its involvement in the Global South. But in that dossier, it has a lot of interesting quotes, which I wanted to pull out because I think it really speaks to A, the real intentions of such an organization, and B, the fact that, these ruling class elites have such a, the facade they put on is so weak because at the end of the day, they just say what they actually mean. And then they think that, we're too stupid to kind of understand. So NATO's first Secretary General, Lord Hastings Lionel Ismay, wrote in an internal memorandum in 1952 that NATO must, quote, this is a direct quote, keep the Soviet Union out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. So I think that really tells us the real aims of NATO, like at its heart, again, is to be kind of this buffer, not buffer really, but kind of like standing force against the Soviet Union, which, on one hand, we don't even, I mean, it's necessary to say that the Soviet Union was responsible for the defeat of fascism in World War II, with over 20 million people kind of sacrificed in that heroic struggle against fascism. It's saying that, they emerged victorious from that war, having defeated fascism. And there was a sense like, okay, the Soviet Union is this major power, and how do we contain its influence? Of course, the NATO is a response to this, and then keep the Americans in. The U.S. Expanding its zone of influence in Western Europe, and Germans down. We obviously don't want Europe to be too powerful, and this continues to be kind of a dynamic of NATO and the U.S. relationship to Europe for decades to come. So that I think that kind of those several words are quite telling. Other, ideologues of the time, George Kennan of the US State Department, made an observation about how the fact that the US has a lot of the world's wealth, but a really small part of its population. And what does this mean as an emerging power that really wants to consolidate its control across the world and sees that, first of all, the Soviet Union is not only kind of the moral victor in World War II, but also has a lot of relationships with peoples of the world. And so George Kennan said, with regards to this kind of contradiction that the United States faces, the disparity is particularly great as between ourselves and the peoples of Asia. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriment to our national security. So, how do we remain the most powerful and the wealthiest nation without angering the people of the world? Because it's clear that there's a contradiction between staying, being such a small part of the world's population, being such a wealthy country, and maintaining so much dominance. And so, how do we make relationships, have not only NATO, but a series of other military alliances to actually make sure that we're subjugating people, we're keeping a good kind of discourse about what the United States is, and having, very strong alliances. So again, that's I think that they kind of speak for themselves. And then, of course, NATO was accompanied by other regional military agreements. So the US had different agreements and kind of formations in Asia, and then also in Latin America at the same time they founded the Organization of American States. NATO and the OAS are the two kind of remaining platforms that were created at this time. Some of the other organizations and military alliances that the US created at this time just kind of withered away because once it built up its network of 800 military bases and regional command structures, they became kind of not important. But of course, encountering the Soviet Union's influence in Europe was always kind of this strategic necessity of the United States. And as we'll see, once the Soviet Union fell, there were more reasons why NATO could exist and more reasons why the United States had to continue subjugating Europe. So I don't know, that's some details, some overview. Hopefully that goes in the right direction.
Yeah, no, that's great. And it's good that you mentioned that kind of resource for the Tricontinental. I've got that right in front of me. That's going to be my holy Bible for this episode. But it does shed a lot of light on the, I guess, the background of NATO. It's got quite a flowery image that's been created since its inception, as it was just a response to, war and everything. We're trying to make sure that doesn't happen again. But truth be told, it was in direct opposition to socialism. It's been its primary goal to halt the growth of the Soviet Union, hinder it by any means possible, and re-establish, dominance within Europe, essentially, as you put it. And of course, putting Germany down, not giving it the chance to become one of the kind of backlash states, as I'll come on to talk about in a wee minute. But yeah, even NATO's kind of inception. The date of it, 1949, is, oh yeah, that's when it was birthed. But in reality, it was 1945, back at the San Francisco Conference, when it was formed, ratified by the 50 participants of the UN Charter. So you've got, already, like we said, the foundations for it were already laid. It just needed that formal meeting, hence after. That way, those coming on board into this organization are all kind of playing on the same tabletop. They know what their roles and responsibilities are. And this is what the US wants, so this is what you're going to go do. And the kind of organizations that have been involved since, and amongst it in the background, because I think we think of NATO, obviously, you think of the North, the kind of developed world, if you like. But it's also had its claws in the global South, and it's done that as a means to, achieve its objectives as well. It's all good with NATO being a defensive alliance, but those part of it are those those weapons manufacturers and everyone else in between. So that requires that resource extraction from the global south and keeping them down as well. It's such a kind of poisonous history. It does make you sick, really looking at the full depth of NATO, how involved it was in every other counter-revolutionary mission in the global south, from Africa and everywhere else in between, Latin America as well, with the organization of American states being involved. So, it's really one of those organizations. At first, it seems like this thing that's been created in one sense, and it's down the road, it somehow just went astray. Nobody's to blame for this. It's just how it's happened, but its foundations tell a much different story to what we're led to believe. And even since then, the fall of the Soviet Union, the illegal overthrow of it, the fact that NATO was supposed to be this self-defense pact and then obviously changed into that a very visible force against the Soviet Union, you'd naively think, well, there we go, there's no need for it to exist anymore, so it should dissolve. But the NATO wasn't for it. They had to have this new enemy now. They've got this capitalist class vested in it. It's representing the interests of so many, well, so few, for so many millions, for so many billions. So now they've got to find this new enemy, this new presence, and that's kind of what they've done. We're looking at kind of new fears of authoritarianism, pinning the new Russia and the People's Republic as these figures. They have to find new terrorists. Now, Al Qaeda, formerly the Mujahideen, the very monster that the CIA and these NATO forces, created in the past. And so, with this new enemy, they've had to, or even with the dictators, if we're saying about the global south, they've had to find new dictators, former puppet men that they've used to overthrow revolutions and people's struggles for liberation against colonial masters. It's their same puppets that they've now got as their enemies. And even opposition figures who are against American imperialism have their own visions. They are now the bad guy. Historically, would have been like some Gaddafi, etc. So we see these new models, new figures now. That's the new NATO role, if you like. And I think over the past couple of years, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and the growing wave of yellow peril, if you like, that's coming back. The anti-China rhetoric, it's been wild up here in Scotland the past couple of years, with vicious stories of secret police stations opening in Chinese restaurants. Utterly ludicrous stuff, and that's been a big driving point to grant that concession, or sorry, that consent for Britain, other NATO allies, America, to do what it does best, and that's encircle military bases all around it, conducting these joint military exercises and training drills near the borders of China, Russia, etc. And ultimately, this growing wave of hostility, of warmongering, and rearmament is led to kind of this boiling point of history, I guess, where we are now. I think probably looking years back during NATO's foundations and the backdrop from the wake of the Second World War, and nuclear development for weaponry, energy, was the big question, and it's still there. It's almost in the background now. Everybody just is kind of aware of a nuclear weapons Armageddon, etc. But the main focal point is again that kind of expansionism by the US, and from the break of the Warsaw Pact, the agreements that were made during the time of the German Democratic Republic, that there would be no forward growth, etc. All these former promises have just been totally wiped out the window, but only to NATO and her allies, the states that have had been involved with it, were fully aware of the consequence of what this entailed. And again, it's that backdrop of history that has been chosen to be ignored by the Murdoch press, various governments, and the EU, and they'll only look to Russia as being rogue. They've done this roguely. They've not played our game. But Russia's invasion of Ukraine came as a direct consequence of breaches of this former pact. So the fact that that's been ignored, history's been able to be rewritten, is not by accident. It's been a way for NATO, her allies, and everyone else involved to do what they need to do in the war with Ukraine. And again, we could probably dedicate a whole episode to that. We'd be here for the whole night, but I'll no go too much into that. But yeah, I think that's kind of where we stand. We're looking at NATO's foundations and the fact that it's still a growing monster, especially in today's age. We'll come on shortly just to talk about how the West builds NATO, and that's happening right now as well. So I think when we talk about NATO and people hear about it, it's not a Stone Age figure in history. It's very much alive, much to the dismay of the billions of people affected by it across the globe. So I guess just to move on then, quite liquid, if I do say so myself. We've put ourselves quite well onto that topic. So just to see if you can give us a kind of rundown then on how the West does build NATO. We have talked about the kind of armed groups that are involved, not just in the crimes in NATO, but the crimes in many armed conflicts across the globe, and the kind of Western trade union complicity, all of this as well. As a GMB member here in Britain, I know all this far too well about how our trade unions here are, carrying this monster NATO in the back quite shamelessly, and the detrimental effect that that has actually even on workers here in the Imperial Corps, never mind the workers abroad who are affected by the bombs and everything else that's dropped, handcrafted by us. So just to see if you can give us a rundown of that, Zoe.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of good points there, and it's important to, I think, within this history also remember kind of like what NATO has actually done. So we know that it's was built again to be kind of this menacing counterblock, to make sure that the quote unquote, obviously this is audio, so important to say in within quotes, the threat of socialism can be contained, and also threats at home, because it's not just today, but for decades, workers in their own countries have been pretty angry that their governments have joined an offensive military alliance, despite it being called a defensive military alliance, and spends significant amount of their GDP into militarism. And so, NATO has also, and the existence of NATO has been kind of this constant, justification and look, we're doing this. This is for the betterment of our country, and really containing kind of domestic opposition. Again, so it's existed as this bloc and has this, battle of ideas that's kind of created around it as why it needs to exist, how it influences and dictates the policy of the member states. Obviously it has its own governance structure, a secretary general, commanders, but it really is kind of this like truth or like trust alliance where people are members of it. They have to abide by certain rules. Of course, the famous attack, an attack against one is an attack against all, which doesn't, it's an interesting Western exceptionalism concept. And it has, as a bloc, gone to war several times and invaded different countries. And so, of course, we know the its role in Yugoslavia, in mass devastation there, its role in the invasion of Afghanistan, and of course, in 2011 in Libya. And it is able to kind of, because of it being an alliance and an agreement, member states kind of pledge certain amount of, soldiers to participate in like joint command operations. But largely, NATO is really functions as this kind of like not policy apparatus, but essentially like a coercive agreement in terms of how governments should administer their budgets. And I think it's interesting because we talk a lot about neoliberalism and how it dictates countries' budgets and austerity policies. But I think NATO and these military agreements play a really massive role into that. And so when we're thinking about like why countries are pursuing austerity policies, trade unions, as you said, there's we'll get to the part about trade union complicity. Trade unions talk about a lot about, why governments are cutting social programs. NATO has a lot to do with this. And historically, it has had the rule of all members have to dedicate 2% of their GDP towards military spending, because why would you go into a military alliance with someone whose military is less developed than yours? Everyone has to have their military to a certain standard, because otherwise, it's sort of like the US is, as Donald Trump says, kind of subsidizing the rest of the world. And so, of course, it's very important to manufacture consent amongst your population that you're getting this great service. Being part of NATO is kind of like a prize. Like, you get the protection of, the rest of the Western Europe and the important countries of the civilized world that are all spending money on their military so they can protect you. And so I think this narrative has been essential to once again, like, justifying austerity policies, justifying the fact that 2%, first it's just 2% has to be dedicated to military spending. Now it's 5%. And so, on one hand, there's kind of a lot of justifications that governments will use. Within the United States, I mean, having we have, I mean, there's a Tricontinental, another really great report, which really highly recommend. It's actually a study, and it's called it's on hyperimperialism, and it talks about U.S. military spending and actually uses really interesting calculations to get the true number that the U.S. and its allies actually spend on the military. And the US-led military bloc, which includes NATO and non-NATO allies, basically this bloc accounts for 74.3% of world military spending. So that means that and the US makes up for 53% of that. So it's essentially saying, like, if you're part of our club, you have to be spending a significant amount of your budget on the military. And I mean, there's a lot of reasons for why they make that kind of rule. One major reason is, of course, for the US to have military dominance across the world and have strong allies, which it can count on to kind of respond in any situation, which we have seen. But also it's an economic calculation, because they want those countries to be spending and buying from US weapons manufacturers. So it's really like a lucrative policy imperative. And of course, this doesn't seem progressive at all. All of this seems like it's pretty anti-people. It seems like it would be kind of against people's interests completely. So, but the point that you bring in of Western trade union complicity is like, how do they actually make this palatable to the people? And there are a lot of instances of trade unions in the West that have kind of bought into this militarism discourse. And I think in the past year, we've seen this in a very intense way. And I'm sure people within Britain and in Scotland would have a lot more experience with this, because we're seeing it across Europe right now as European governments are kind of scrambling after Donald Trump cut off some amount of military aid to Ukraine. They have to kind of figure out how to sell this. So they say, the military creates jobs. If we invest in manufacturing, and if we invest, sorry, weapons manufacturing, if we start building weapons at home, This is actually going to create more jobs. This is gonna beef up the economy. People are gonna, maybe they won't be working on fixing bridges, but they will be employed. And this is, of course, ridiculous, but it is kind of how Western governments are able to try to sell this complete sellout. Of course, all of this has, all of their policy objectives have to have a certain manufacturing of consent because otherwise people would revolt. And I think we'll talk about later why, kind of how to counter this. But it's really important to underscore that anytime the military industrial complex is favored by a country's national budget, it is never in favor of workers. There might be, in some cases, temporary jobs created when you open up a new weapons or a parts factory in your country, but this is not in any way kind of developing people's national economies. Every percentage point that's put towards military spending is money that's not put towards health, education, and housing, which people desperately need. And people, within Europe would know very well that since 2022, Europe has been in like a protracted economic crisis, massive austerity cuts, job losses. So how is it that now there's all of this money to A, support the war effort in Ukraine, and B, build up the national military. So I know it's a lot of points, but I think it brings out a lot of the contradictions that these countries are facing, where they have to spend to be part of NATO. They have to justify this like increased military spending because allegedly they're getting this great protection, but at the same time, it's obviously in complete contradiction to the well-being of the people in their countries.
Yeah, very well put, Zoe, and especially on kind of Trump's vision of NATO, and certainly with his views on the kind of Russia-Ukraine war. Trump represents this other, I guess, other side of the ruling class that recognizes, it's invested that a good bit in its previous operations with the CIA involvement, the Euromaidan protests, etc. And they haven't made the inroads they want to, and instead want to kind of consolidate and make up their losses. They've been very quick to open up new arms manufacturing plants even within Ukraine as the war goes on. And Trump's kind of taken that step back to not put all of his chips, if you like, on this one bet, and instead kind of focusing in the wider, not even a Cold War, probably a sub-zero war against China. That's still the big drive for them. So if there's some way that Trump can forge his own concessions in amongst the ruling class in Russia for what he's wanting to do, for what others in Europe are staging alongside him, that's what they'll seek to accomplish, whilst the kind of liberal bills that lead the charge and the EU are wanting to maintain expenditure growth in NATO. And the way you analyze the kind of how it builds up with this GDP increase, it's that scaremongering as well, even within the kind of different member nations, pointing the finger at each other. They're no increase in their expenditure. They must be a shell of Putin. They must be on the payroll of Xi Jinping, XYZ, all the rest. And that's really how they begin to do it. You see these fingers starting to be pointed and letting the tensions boil as well, even within the whole the European homeland, if you like. And then that feeds into not just what's happening in the political scene, but within the trade unions. And that's it. You touched on it perfectly. And it's sad that the modern slogan for the trade unions isn't "Workers of the World Unite." It instead is "Jobs for me, bombs for thee." And they'll do anything. Trade union leaders and these bureaucrats who here in Britain were never able to find their careerist role within the Labour Party or their preferred establishment role, having instead chosen to kind of parasitically crawl their way into the trade union structures, and instead are just doing this big drive, and it's like you said, you know, it creates jobs, but they're also towing the exact same talking points as some of the largest war hawks of the world. You know, they'll say we need to have these jobs in manufacturing component parts, etc., for Israel, because Palestine and what's in it is a danger to our way of life and our freedoms. And the same goes for the talking points against Russia and how dangerous they are. You know, they don't have our interests, so we have to make sure we get these jobs to protect our own. But the last time I checked, the British ruling class doesn't represent the interests of the workers here, and it's such a shame that there's so many young trade union members and certainly active young trade unionists who are almost being groomed into this kind of imperialist marching line without realizing that when push comes to shove, especially here in Britain with such a kind of weakened military, that it'll be these same workers of this same age that'll be the first ones shipped in the front lines, or if they're lucky to maintain their job because it's deemed as directly involved to the war effort, then the very workplaces that these people will spend most of their lives in become targets, essentially become targets for bombing campaigns, etc. So, you know, what kind of future is that for the young people of Europe, and indeed the world, America, especially with how it builds up its war machine? What kind of future is that to know that you'll be the first one to be conscripted, to be sent off to die either in the snow, sand, or tundra, all for austerity? Because that's what's kind of plaguing almost the world, if you like, especially across Europe than now, as you've highlighted in Britain. But it's the exact same. You know, we're being told by likes of Rachel Reeves in Westminster that there simply is, quote, no magic money tree for spending in the NHS, for improving our local services. But just behind her is a Garden of Eden for Elbit Systems, Lockheed Martin, and for any of the other private firms to dip their hand in and rake the leaves of. So, you know, it's this massive contradiction that, you know, the progressive forces of the left across the globe have to highlight, and more importantly, bring back the message of wars to the domestic scene, because there's so many people now who would look for, I guess, smaller conflicts as they'd see it, such as Israel and Palestine, and they go, well, what's that to do with us? That has no bearing on my shopping or, you know, my local services. But it does, because it's all that money's been going to support that ongoing genocide, whilst you can't get a bus because they've all been privatized. Your shopping prices are so high because, you know, they're upping the prices. And your local services no longer exist because they've been sold off to the highest bidder, privatized, not deemed profitable, and then just shut down. So I think one of the wider areas in how we convey the message of NATO and, you know, constant war is to bring it back to the domestic scene, tie in, you know, how NATO builds itself based on this extortion of us, essentially, of our GDP, our money, our taxpayers' money into this war machine, and how any global conflict that was to kick off tomorrow, every single conscripted soldier, young age, etc., would die for nothing, because they've got nothing. We own no nationalized services, essentially. They're all going into the hands of private profiteers. So what are people being asked to essentially fight for at the end of the day? But that kind of war mongering, the scare, the fear, the hysteresy, you know, that will all be like flammed up again to paint whoever is involved as that new great enemy. Russia will be the authoritarian, you know, catastrophe for the world. China, if the West goes to war and seeks or completes, sorry, its mission of expansionism in that region, you know, China will be the new USSR. You know, we've let them go on for too long enough, and now it's time to intervene. But the likes of using Taiwan as their Ukraine, These sacrificial pawns that are just pieces to be flown about, and it really doesn't take much, as we kind of saw in these. Although it doesn't take much, these events don't just happen in the vacuum. That's years, these protracted games of years of rearmament, broken promises, expansionism, these really small things that mount up and mount up till before you know what bayonets are pointed at each other. I think it's John McLean, who's one of our kind of historical figures here in Scotland, is a communist. He highlights that a bayonet is a weapon with a worker at both ends. So that's, I think now's the time more than ever to really expose NATO for what it is, how it does it, and even how our own union movement plays the part in that, and granting austerity, essentially. On one hand, it will say, we're on the fight for austerity to make sure workers get what they deserve, but at the same time, we're letting Elbit Systems, Lockheed Martin, BAE get away with crimes against our class, both domestically and internationally. So I thought that was really well put, Zoe. And again, puts us well onto our next point there as well. The importance of covering topics of NATO via kind of worker-led media. We highlighted this at kind of the start, the importance, why worker-led media is great in this fight, in contradiction to the Murdoch press. But just to see if you can give us a wee rundown of that as well.
Yeah, it's so essential because, exactly what you're highlighting is that, the leaders of the NATO bloc are saying, look, we're doing this for you. We're protecting our way of life. We're protecting our countries. And they're actually not invested at all in the people of their countries. They're actually not investing in the well-being of the people of their countries. So that kind of attempt to even use this chauvinist discourse that it's all about protecting our way of life is really hollow, because for them what it's about is protecting their corporate interests, the stock market, the interests of the military firms that are producing the weapons that they're buying. It's not about protecting the doctors, the teachers, the workers in their countries. And so that's why I think, efforts like People's Dispatch, like Morning Star, and so many other left media projects in that are covering this are so essential because it's necessary to cut through these lies. And I think that the last year, Trump has done a lot. he's done a lot of bad, but I think that his brazenness about how he sees the war in Ukraine has really put European leaders in this very awkward position because essentially they are now presenting themselves as kind of the cheerleaders for war. And so when this 20-point peace plan was presented, European leaders went into this crazy frenzy and they're like, fuck, like how do we continue the war? How do we change all of this? Like, what is Trump doing? Why did he cut us out of the process? Our concerns weren't listened to at all. And it's like, yeah, this was never about you. This was never about the well-being of Europe. Trump simply decided that he doesn't want to invest as much US resources into that front. As you said, the focus is now China and containing China. Let Europe deal with Europe's problem. And as we saw these, NATO member states in Europe just scrambling, how are we going to come up with the money? It becomes very clear that it's not about the Ukrainian people. It's not about reaching peace. It's not about coming to a solution of peace, but it's really about how do we continue to kind of prop up this threat of war to pursue our interests. And that's exactly what they're doing. So I think all of the narratives that are able to cut through this insane warmongering discourse are so important. And at People's Dispatch, we've really find it important to highlight not only, covering what's being said at these summits, all the different NATO summits that there have been, these emergency leadership meetings of the Europeans where they kind of like panic and talk about, why war has to continue, but also the struggles of the internationalists, to say this kind of trade unions, who are not only, demanding labor protections, demanding health care, but also demanding an end to war. And I think that the Palestine Solidarity Movement has brought out a lot of this sentiment, and people are really understanding that their own tax dollars, which they've been told aren't enough to fund what they need, aren't enough to, actually ensure that they have a future, are somehow now being used to fund wars across the world. And so a lot of the research that I think has been so valuable that people have done in countries across Europe to show how their tax dollars are being used to manufacture parts, or how their ports are being used to ship is, weapons to Israel, is also, deeply tied to the NATO logistics routes. It's tied to NATO bases. And I think this advance forward in resisting militarism, understanding, European support to Israel is also European support to this NATO project, I think has been really clarifying for a lot of people. And, one thing that, this genocide has done is actually bring so many more people out into the streets to demand an end to militarism and to demand an end to their government's complicity in this. And so we've seen this in the strikes that have happened. We've seen this in the, actions at the ports that have happened. And it's really inspiring. And I think at a moment when, in 2022, when the war in Ukraine started, I mean, the propaganda was pretty bad in the United States, but when I saw what was being broadcast in Europe, I really couldn't believe it, because it was like, levels of Russophobia, levels of just national chauvinism that felt kind of apocalyptic, and just constantly talking about this threat, like you'd think Europe has never seen war before. And they were just so excited to exploit this moment of pain, of real fear for people's well-being, to just push their agenda. NATO is now more important than ever. NATO is our only hope. This is why we need NATO. These are all the reasons why Russia's bad and why we're going to be next. And it was just this frenzy. It pulled a lot of people from the center left to that side. I think we saw a lot of unfortunate, shifts of people who maybe had a more progressive agenda suddenly become war hawks and warmongers. I think there's few organizations, and I think the Communist Party of Britain had a really principled stance, to calling out what was happening for what it was, which was, warmongering, which was trying to say that this happened, in a vacuum. Of course, there's historical roots for what happened in 2022. And it was really, I think it remains so important that these voices are shared and heard, because so much of what was said by forces that seemed like they were isolated, that seemed like, they were constantly getting attacked by liberal media. I'm sure the Communist Party of Britain was getting extremely attacked by these like pro-war voices. That perspective was the one that, has the most sense today. And people that were saying that, Russia's going to invade all of Europe, I mean, they look pretty silly right now. And the, Boris Johnson intervening to stop a peace proposal from happening, what does that say? Now, many, several more years down the line, there's still no peace, and thousands more people have died. So what is the, what is the role of Europe? And so I think exposing all of that is so important, showing that, not just having this kind of negative perspective, but showing that there are people who are taking to the streets, demanding peace, understanding that for, the youth in Europe to have a future, to have a present, for the youth across the world to have a future and present, militarism is not the way forward. And that defending health, defending education, and standing with the peoples of the world who are resisting, NATO threats, who are resisting threats of war from the United States, standing with the people of Venezuela, standing with the people of the Alliance of Sahel States, with the people of Mali, with the people of Burkina Faso and Niger, who are under constant threat of Western military invasion. Standing with those struggles and defending the right to a sovereign foreign policy, which the US does not want Europe to have, is the way forward. And so we've been trying to cover that in our, at People's Dispatch in a consistent way, and make people understand what's happening, be able to read between the lines, but also know that there's struggle happening. A lot of people say, especially in the global south, that Europe's the lost continent. And we try to prove that wrong. We try to prove that there is really principled and important struggle that's happening across the continent. There is an independent voice. There are voices that say another Europe is possible, and it's not one that supports warmongering. It's not one that supports imperialism. It's not one that supports colonialism. And it is growing every single day. And I think we have, the Palestine Solidarity Movement in a large part to thank for that. And as we see the threat of war against Venezuela growing, it'll be really important that these forces continue to stand up and to make their voices heard.
Yeah, very well put. And like you says, we kind of Trump has shaken up of Europe and kind of having these different member states kind of scrambling is perhaps one of the most vital points for worker-owned and worker-led media to kind of cut through that and hunt them down whilst they're on the run, essentially looking for a talking point that's going to get them out of trouble and not expose them for what they've done. And that's the general role, I guess, of our class-based medias is to do that, because like you said, it's subjects like Boris Johnson being involved in essentially breaking down those peace talks. That was not reported any clearer on the Murdoch Own Press, the BBC, wherever. The Morning Star explicitly covered that to say that this is what happened, and that was exposed at various trade union conferences through motions in opposition to the kind of growing war and the rearmament of Europe and expansionism of NATO, that this is the role that state leaders are playing. They're not rolling out the red carpet for themselves every time they go abroad sometimes, or they're doing the stuff in the background to make sure the massive work of peace negotiations does fail, and that has to be highlighted to know that. Again, like you said, these leaders aren't interested in these peace deals. They don't care about that. That's not what they're looking for. So any kind of puppetry or kind of showmanship by them is just exactly what it is. It's a farce. And like you says, with the importance there, we're workers as well. We're highlighting some of these the major topics. It doesn't only expose the likes of Boris Johnson, etc., Trump, but again, bring it back to our movement, our trade union and progressive movement, where so many are falling over this exact same line. And it's very crucial at a time where it's a strange way to see history repeat itself on the news with these stories really cheering on war and everything. And looking at Twitter, and I'm seeing a video of a German general pointing with a stick towards like areas of Ukraine. I'm like, seen this before in textbooks. This is discerning. I can't have a German general looking this happy pointing at a map of Ukraine again. But again, we'll get the people in our own movements who champion that exact same imagery and are happy to work as hard as possible to shut down motions going forward at trade union conferences in opposition to war, especially kind of here in Britain. In Scotland, we've got quite a unique position with our STUC, the Scottish Trade Union Congress, where obviously all the major unions representative in Scotland meet. Our trades councils exist in Scotland, and these trade councils are essentially bodies of trade unionists within local communities. They exist kind of outside the realms of the rules and amendments, almost, if you like, of the actual main unions. So it's led to Scotland having a much more radical approach to our trade union strategy in Scotland. But again, as history showed us, the ruling class will try to intertwine into anything to make sure that, well, their interests are met. And that happens with our trade councils also. With some, calling out others as being agents for Russia for promoting peace, which is utterly bizarre. But it just goes to show the lengths. But one of the big successes that we can have up here in Scotland, and I think, where comrades in England need to do the same, is to push for their trades councils to be involved within the TUC, which they aren't. Scotland's quite unique in that. But it's led to us here in Scotland to have these progressive motions and solidarity with Palestine to support, to make support available for workers to take industrial action on a principle of, anti-imperialism and anti-genocide. More importantly, it's given us a chance to actually meet with workers within the arms industry. This was a motion that passed last year. We wanted to meet and talk to these workers to, displace the ruling class arguments that are fed to them in the media, but also spoon-fed to them by senior trade union officials and heads of the union. So we're hoping that, that avenue into the workplace, especially, can, prove to help us break that mold, that kind of grip that the ruling class and its subordinate trade unions have on these workers here who, are told just to get on, do your job, and, go out, don't worry about it. Trying to get them to see the much wider picture for what they're seeing, and, how better to expose that than to highlight what their work not only does in a basic level, but in the wider scheme of things, how it's involved with NATO, even with the AUKUS alliance as well, and all these other, so-called defense forces of the world that are the only main aim is to, suppress various workers' movements around the globe. So, no, I thought you'd done a really, really great job of covering that, Zoe. And, I guess we can't go a whole episode talking about NATO without highlighting, the war crimes that it's done in the past, but more so looking at, future conflicts that seem to be on the horizon. We've touched on a few. We obviously Russia being one that looks ever more credible. China, likewise. But as you've highlighted, in terms of standing in solidarity with comrades in the global south, especially in Africa, Burkina Faso, etc., those are, possible new testing grounds for the various components, armaments, and weaponry that, Elbit seeks to develop, and the other arms companies as well. So just to see if you can give us a wee kind of rundown of, perhaps some of our most noted war crimes carried out by NATO, by this so-called defense alliance, and where we can see, this possibility of future conflicts.
Yeah, lots of war crimes. If you look at some of the most kind of scathing conflicts of the last 3 decades, you can guess that NATO had a role there. And I think also, importantly, it's not all, there's a list of several where NATO itself, as NATO, intervened. But if we do look at kind of all major military engagements in the past three decades, NATO has had a role, even if it's not directly. But I think its role in the Balkans, enforcing no-fly zones, its intervention in Bosnia, the bombing of the Chinese embassy, the role in Kosovo, horrific bombing campaigns in a region with that was kind of emerging, obviously, from what was Yugoslavia. A lot of the kind of conflicts that emerged in that moment were not, of course, in any way made better by NATO's intervention. This is not, and sometimes these bombing campaigns and these no-fly zones that were established were somehow branded as peacekeeping missions. We obviously know that's not what happened in any way, causing mass atrocities. NATO's role in Afghanistan, this was, I think, the moment where it was really able to rally behind that attack against one is attack against all kind of motto. And the, invasion of Afghanistan and the 2 decades war against the people of Afghanistan is definitely one of kind of the worst crimes of the 21st century, which of course has its roots in the 20th century. And the US already being involved in shaping the political landscape of Afghanistan because of the Cold War, and it's an attempt to kind of stop Soviet involvement in Afghanistan. And so, I mean, I think there's no place that more encapsulates the role of NATO involvement than Afghanistan. I think that's a crucial one, and it was where they were able to kind of consolidate their whole like NATO force. It is like the longest and largest combat mission that NATO has carried out. It played an important role in the invasion of Iraq, training forces. But we know Iraq had kind of a different character in terms of a war, and it used a lot of private military contractors. And as you said, we could talk for a long time about these kind of private military contractors. What countries did these mercenaries come from? There's clearly kind of a revolving door between people who serve in national armies and then become mercenaries. The war in Iraq, another major crime of the 21st century. And I think, as you're from Britain, I'm from the United States, two countries played a major role in trying to and kind of failing to manufacture consent for a completely illegal invasion. Iraq is also a country that had suffered greatly under UN and US sanctions for decades before the invasion. And so there is this kind of pattern of countries that had already been, completely undermined and destroyed by all sorts of policies from the United States and from other NATO countries that then, despite their best efforts, then somehow ends up to be invaded. And so, Iraq and NATO's role there is maybe, smaller than it was in Afghanistan, but of course it's NATO members that were leading the charge in this completely illegal war, which continues till today. There's obviously still US troops in Iraq. Libya, another major war crime, and this is kind of an event that has had repercussions till today. And as we're talking about the Sahel and what's happening in the Sahel, it's something that's reverberates from the 2011 invasion of Libya and overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi and complete destabilization of one of the countries in Africa that was actually quite stable, and a country that was kind of in its way leading in a lot of ways, a lot of efforts across the continent, a major player in building kind of Pan-Africanism. Libya today is really hard to associate with anything else than a war zone. It's a place where there's open air slave markets. It was completely destroyed by this NATO intervention. And again, the impacts and the kind of ripple effect of Libya and the catastrophe in 2011 are still being felt today with the proliferation of armed groups across the Sahel into Western Africa. And as we mentioned, the Sahel countries, there's pretty good evidence to show that the West is behind a lot of these groups. The Sahel countries of Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger accuse France of using the pretext of the war on terror that, of course, started with overthrowing Gaddafi to establish greater military presence in the region. So we can see how like every single one of these military interventions has not ended in peace whatsoever. And interestingly enough, all of these interventions happened outside of Western Europe. And so it's kind of like for some reason the US and its lackeys need to, of course, are intervening and using this North Atlantic mirage to intervene in places that are well outside its borders, and causing destabilization and devastating impacts for people across the global South. And again, there's other instances, but I think Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Balkans overall are kind of the main ones. Kosovo, of course. And of course, your European listeners would have more context for that. But I think the main point here is that what is the aftermath of a NATO intervention? It's not peace, it's not well-being, it's not defense, it's not, people who are better defended for alleged attacks in the future. Oftentimes, it's these interventions happen because of an assessment by the United States. That it's a place where they should intervene, should kind of get a stranglehold over, and can destabilize. Maybe that place is a threat, maybe perceived threat in their determination of what a threat is, and they must kind of subjugate, destabilize, and dismantle. Because I think if we look at what Iraq is today, what Afghanistan is today, it is not in a better place than it was before these interventions.
Yeah, very well said. And either the kind of going into the history, the kind of involvement in NATO and their direct war crimes is one thing, and in itself. But it's played that role as a that old school criminal fixer. We'll get you your guns, your armaments. Yeah, we'll close down the airspace. We'll do this for you, and it's played that kind of background role, if you like, in all these other conflicts as well. It's never just kind of sat in the sidelines, if you like. It's has been involved. It's just not put its branding on it. They've left it either to the US or to Britain and to some of the other countries. But it's been NATO weapons, NATO bombs, NATO intelligence, and everything else in between, kind of used to carry out these atrocities. And when we, I guess, when we talk about these future conflicts, the ones that do look most conceivable. Obviously, there's the one with Russia. Yeah, that's been going on since prior to the 2022 invasion of Ukraine. That America played a very active part in toppling the government through the Euromaidan coup. And again, it's been the consequence of that. What has it led to? Even prior to that, was a consequence of the illegal overthrow of the Soviet state. It's been rampant poverty, privatization, a sickening rise in the likes of child prostitution in the region, all these other things, and that's the consequence. That's the consequence of capitalism. That's a consequence of the free world, if they like to call themselves that, moving in and establishing its order. Look to how fragmentized the Russia became, and Ukraine splitting in two former sister nations who led the charge in defeating fascism in Europe. Now, their grandsons and granddaughters are now carrying out the same salutes as their former enemy in Berlin, and are spilling each other's blood across their soil. So, it's sickening to see. And all that's led to is, again, more financial turmoil for the workers in the region, uncertainty, and how much more uncertain can you get when, looking out your bedroom window when you wake up in the morning, wondering if, a bomb's going to drop on you. But rest and be thankful, knowing that it'll say NATO on it, freedom we love, and that'll be the last thing you see. So this build up has just been going even since the overthrow of the Soviet Union. But as well as that, the growth the war against China, I touched briefly on the AUKUS alliance as well. That's just been another kind of pet project with the likes of Australia and some of the other nations within the region. They were part of I think it was the Five Eyes kind of security alliance as well, to gather intelligence, to gather what they need in order to be ready and be prepared for a future conflict like this. And China has it's not faltered, it's not wavered, it's still been on this desire for peace, for cooperation, and in the kind of face of NATO and the likes of Trump shaking everything up, like we talked about. You've also got the backdrop of the building of BRICS as well, and amongst the global south. So now that's kind of a new face that NATO, the North, if you like, has to, be aware of. It's no longer a case of these nations having to, fully submit to the likes of the US. There's a dent and a damage to its hegemony. And what does that play out in a wider world? Does it mean hesitance, or does it mean the likes of NATO, or the US and the EU launching their own branded offensives against these nations who dare to challenge their whims and their ways? And I guess when we talk about the kind of future conflicts, obviously the bombs dropping and abroad, but what does it mean for the people at home? We highlighted that conscription is a real possibility. It's already been a possibility, or sorry, it's already been a reality for workers in Ukraine, workers in Russia. There's every chance of that happening within Europe and within Britain, especially with the state of its military. And it'll be young people, like we said, dying for nothing. So I thought you covered that really well, Zoe. That was fantastic. Thank you very much for that. And I guess that brings us on to the last point, which I wish was easy, how to beat NATO. I wish it was an easy answer. I wish it was just a case of finding a time machine, going back to 1945 and telling Stalin just to keep going west. But unfortunately, it's not that simple. And it's as long-winded as the kind of history of NATO and the kind of struggle. So I guess just looking from yourself, how do you see this monster? How do we actually, defeat this thing? If we've already recognised that NATO isn't just Europe's burden or the workers of Europe's burden, it's instead a global beast that has to be slain.
Well, I think NATO is just one part of the US's kind of military infrastructure. And so, it's about beating NATO, about dismantling NATO, but also, beating this military lobby in our countries, beating, I mean, it's is essentialist class struggle, because in countries of the global north, where our governments are highly invested in waging war across the world and investing so much of their GDP for this aim, it is, it has to be part of every single struggle we engage in. And I think that right now, because Europe has been facing this, cost of living crisis in countries across the region, and it obviously it was, the cost of living crisis, and really the capitalist crisis in these countries far predates 2022. I think there is like a really strong correlation between Europe completely giving in to US demands, and even its own kind of like posturing that, okay, we're gonna not import gas from Russia anymore. We're gonna completely cut all ties with Russia, completely cut all ties. And of course, this hasn't happened with China. We're gonna deprioritize this relationship to completely prioritize our relationship with the United States, give in to its every single whim on military spending, on, oil and gas and energy deals. And where has this got Europe? It really hasn't gotten it much advances. And I think the people are really feeling that. And so this point of agitation of saying, we need our own foreign policy, we need our own domestic policy, and following, the dictates of the United States is a losing sum game. I mean, Europe was not spared from the US's reciprocal, I'll say Donald Trump's reciprocal tariff regime. It was not spared from, these extremely heavy tariffs, and it will continue to suffer under not only, the tariffs imposed by Donald Trump, but also its complete isolation from its natural allies. And so this becomes really important in being able to open people's eyes to the reality of what it means to be part of NATO. It's not just a military alliance, it's an alliance that dictates every single level of policy, from foreign policy to domestic policy to energy policy. And so actually securing a future for people in Europe means breaking free of NATO. And this is, obviously it's a struggle that has to take place in every sector. It's a struggle that needs, the trade unions to understand that the future of work is not in the military, but it actually is in investing in roads, it's in investing in, in production. Europe is falling behind in a lot of areas, and European leaders have even admitted that its over-reliance on the United States is creating a situation of economic backwardness. Does Europe have a sovereign economy? I think the answer is probably no. We already know it doesn't have a sovereign foreign policy. And so, obviously there's alliances to be made in so many sectors of society. And within the United States, this struggle of course continues. There was, when the war in Ukraine first broke out, there were, again, isolated voices, but strong voices that opposed this. And I think as Donald Trump has completely shifted his tune, a lot of the liberals that, should be anti-war, and had kind of rallied behind Joe Biden going gung-ho, supporting Ukraine, are now the ones that are isolated. And more people are seeing that the US sending billions of dollars of military aid to Ukraine was really for nothing. Because years have gone by, there's no peace. People are starting to kind of question why was it that so much money was going towards this? And now people are in such a difficult situation within the country, economically. And so it's these kind of moments where it's necessary to intervene and say, okay, like where, right now there's billions of dollars being spent on the US military buildup in the Caribbean. Billions of dollars being spent on that. And just a month ago, millions of people lost health insurance because both the Democrats and the Republicans decided that guaranteeing health access for millions of people was not a priority. And so, we have to be intervening at all of these points, demanding that what is spent on the military decrease, demand that, this money, the 5% now that's going to go into the military spending, be actually instead spent on health and education. It's the time to kind of rebuild links with movements from across the world. We can't fight NATO without being in dialogue with movements from the global south who are not only resisting, NATO militarism, but the presence of troops from the members of NATO. So there's a lot to be done, and I think it's actually the The initial boost that NATO got from the beginning of the war in Ukraine has completely kind of fallen because people are seeing what a hoax that was and how this completely worked against their interests. And now they're going to see it even more, unfortunately, as these contradictions continue to sharpen, as people's material conditions continue to get worse, and as their governments continue to spend more money into propping up a war that's just causing suffering. It's going to become more and more clear to people that there has to be another way and that the struggle is the only way that we're going to achieve that. So it's actually a hopeful moment. It's now is the time more than ever to engage in that struggle, to join an organization wherever you may be that is engaging in that fight because, unfortunately, as you said, we don't have time machines. And the only way to get a better future is to fight for it, is to fight the expansion of current wars, is to educate people. And, it's not necessary to necessarily, use to talk about imperialism, but we can just talk about the fact that, the heating bills are increasing. We're facing, insane weather, freezing temperatures. Somehow we're paying more and more for heating our homes, and still all of this money is going abroad to funding war. That simply doesn't make sense. So there's a lot to be done, and there's a lot to get excited about, and fighting it is the only way. Fighting back, fighting our elites that would rather line the pockets of the military contractors, of the weapons companies, that's the only way forward.
Oh, fantastic, Zoe. Inspirational stuff. That's great. And that's kind of it, isn't it? It's not just a singular fight. It's a much wider struggle. It's a class struggle. And that's not always against the figureheads that we see in the mainstream press and everything. Sometimes it's rooting out the kind of scabs and the class traitors within our movement as well. I've done an article for the Morning Star kind of on this very thing and how for certain workers within Europe and here in Britain and Scotland, how we can see such mass industrial action being taken in support for Palestine, etc. But it's not happening here and that scale in terms of strikes or dock workers refusing to load goods to Israel or goods from Israel. Why is it we see that? And we see that because our trade union movement has been made so kind of flaccid over the years. It's been stripped of any kind of radicalism of class politics, and the class traitors in charge of our union have done a very good job in making sure that the trade union model has regressed from worker solidarity to workersinsurance.org. That's what it's like. Workers don't see the unions being a force. They just see them as being, something that exists. They sign up to it in case they ever get in trouble, but they won't properly engage with it because it's essentially become alien to them because these unions are no longer truly representing their needs beyond wages, pay conditions, etc. The union movement has regressed so far, and it's not been an accident. It's not happened in a vacuum. It's a calculated effort with those in charge doing the work of the ruling class. But on, I guess, on a brighter note for how to beat NATO and the wider class struggle, it's by forces such as these, such as People's Dispatch, of worker-owned media, such as the Morning Star, etc., all intertwining, cooperating, publishing items through institutions such as Tricontinental, exposing NATO, making these resources available so they can be used wherever we are, especially in sectors such as the defense sector or weapons, etc., etc., to expose, what's really going on, and more importantly, that the wider class solidarity is for us to play that role within and without the union movement and the progressive forces to make that principled stance and fight for what we can fight for in terms of peace. The devastation of the Iraq War and other conflicts that Britain's been involved in, and the US as well, have been catastrophic. But imagine how much more catastrophic they would have been without any opposition if they were just given the green light to do exactly what they wanted to do. So that's the kind of role that we play in. And you know, it's always obviously great to you know talk to comrades from over the pond and across the globe, and we're seeing the exact same struggles, and that's what we have to emulate, the fact that what's happening here in Britain, it's happening in America, it's happening in Europe, it's happening where capitalism's just running rampant and continues to grow into this, you know, grotesque monster of imperialism. And it requires everybody to realize that, you know, it has to be a united fight against it. NATO is just a small beast in comparison to the wider war machine and what that means, especially in this kind of new age of nuclear warfare. And the consequences of that as well. So I thought I was really well put, Zoe. So again, I thank you for that. And just to finish off then, just any kind of final talking points from yourself, where can you find you on social media? Where can people, you know, tune into People's Dispatch and everything else in between?
Yeah, well, I think, this is a really urgent conversation, and as I said before, and as you've mentioned, this isn't just a historical conversation. This is something that's happening every day, that's developing every day. Currently on December 29th, we still haven't seen this threatened attack against Venezuela, but the US has been every single day for the past 3 months threatening war against Venezuela. There are threats of war against people across the world, and so this struggle is imperative. The struggle against militarism, the struggle in defense of peace and in defense of the dignity and sovereignty of the people of the world. It's something that we have to keep fighting for, because it is, in our it's happening now, whether we like it or not. So let's keep defending peace. Let's keep uncovering what's really happening. What are the interests behind all of these war efforts? And with that, I'd say you can follow a lot of this at People's Dispatch, which on all social media platforms is at People's Dispatch, peoplesdispatch.org. We just published a really fantastic piece on the conflict, the war in Sudan, and unmasking a lot of these points. Like, what are the actual economic interests behind this war? What are the fa like what are the factions even fighting over? What are the interests of the Gulf states in this war? What are the interests of the United States' participation? I think in all of these devastating wars and conflicts, it's never as it's never face value what it seems. And so the war in Sudan is no exception. And there's lots that we need to be doing there. So highly recommend people check out peoplesdispatch.org, and follow worker-led media. Morningstar is a great resource. I get it to my inbox every single day. Glad to be in dialogue and in collaboration with all of the comrades there. And the only way out of this crisis is forward in struggle. So I'm glad to be in struggle with all of you comrades and fighting for a better future.
Perfect, Zoe. Thanks again for obviously taking the time out your busy schedule and everything.
Yeah, of
And
course.
even in the festive period, there's no rest for the wicked. So
No.
thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. Hopefully it was comprehensible, legible. So yeah, have a good, enjoy the rest of your year, and happy New Year. Happy winter solstice.
Thanks again, comrades, for tuning in to another episode of Spectre. As always, be sure to share this with your friends, comrades, co-workers, and anyone else in between. And of course, be sure to leave us a review on whatever platform you're tuning in on. The fight against NATO is indeed the fight against the wider war and imperialism. NATO stands merely as a beast in the wider machine of war. A figurehead which has already done so much damage to the workers' movement across the globe. NATO seeks to maintain the US rules-based system and prevent other countries from developing. That is what makes NATO the most dangerous and reactionary organization in the world today. And it's exactly why we must fight it. As mentioned, it's historically played its key role in fighting and squashing socialism. It does not care for the civilian casualties involved in such a mission. It must press its boot down on those abroad as well as domestically, which is why our fight against NATO has to be interlinked internationally with the workers of the world. Only together can we hope to beat NATO and hold all of its warmongers and criminals to account from each of our nations. The only way to stop a drive to total nuclear annihilation is by opposing war wherever we're based. It means being active in our trade union movements, in our tenants' unions, in our peace networks, and anywhere else we're involved with. Because if global war is not averted, then we're all involved in its wake. So let's fight for peace. Let's fight for our class, and let's fight for a future that the workers are in charge of the world, not the warmongers, the war hawks, and the criminals. Let's fight for socialism. Let's fight for communism.
Rag pussy.
Hey yo, camouflage chameleon, ninja skill in your building. No time to grab the gun, they already got your wife and children. A hit was sent from the president to raid your residence because you had secret evidence and documents on how they raped the continents. Enlist the prominent, dominant Islamic, Asiatic, black Hebrew, the year 2002. The battle's still with the rules. 6 million devils just died from the bubonic flow of the Ebola virus under the reign of King Cyrus. You can see the weakness of a man right through his iris. Unlord, you snakes get throwing in boiling lakes of hot oil. Uncoils your skin. Chicken heads getting slim like olive oil. Only plant the seed deep inside fertile soil. Fortified with essential vitamin and minerals. Use the sky for blanket stuff and cloud inside my pillow. Rolling with the lamb. 12 tribes, 144,000 chosen. Protons, electrons, always cause explosions.